All of us need to be rescued. At some stage in your life, you will need to be rescued physically. It was just a couple of years ago that you and I were glued to our TV screens or to our computers, and we were watching the scenes of the Chilean miners who were caught deep underground in a Chilean mine. And for day after day, it played out on our TV screens about whether these miners would be able to be rescued. The testimonies of the miners were that they thought they were gone. They thought that everyone thought that they were dead. Until technology allowed the people on the outside to, in a sense, bore their way down into the very shutter, in a sense, underneath the ground where the miners were barely surviving. And through that sort of hole that they bored down into this sort of bunker in the ground, they were able to pass to them things that they could live off, food and water and life-giving nutrients. And the miners talked about the amazing act when they actually broke through into their bunker and they were supplied with the food. They couldn't believe that in the midst of their darkness, in the midst of their oppression, in the midst of their discouragement, they couldn't believe that someone was actually going to rescue them, that there was actually hope, that there was actually going to be light coming through that hole that was bored down to them. And that's really our theme coming out of the book of Exodus. The people who are living in Egypt are in great darkness. For 400 years, these people are being oppressed and afflicted. They're in a state of discouragement and fear and angst. And they wonder if anyone will ever be able to rescue them. In the first narrative that we looked through just 2 weeks ago, we discovered that Pharaoh was a wicked master. We discovered that Joseph, who was Jacob's famous son, rose to great prominence in the nation of Egypt. In fact, he was roughly perhaps about the prime minister and only answered to Pharaoh himself. But then it says in Exodus chapter 1, if you're turning there, that after Pharaoh died, a new Pharaoh rose up. There was an overthrow in the government. And Joseph was old news. Joseph and his family were old news. They went back to being the shepherd people. The people without education, the people who weren't really that popular, even though they lived in a nice area of Egypt, which Pharaoh gave to them, they went back to being the despised people of God. And so through this whole book, the book of the Exodus, the big question is, will God be able to rescue his people? And yet as we looked at Egypt, we also look at our world. We think about what people need to be rescued from in our world. Alcoholism. Many different types of addictions, pornography, all kinds of things when you pick up the Daily Mail or you pick up the Guardian or whatever you do when you turn on the news and you hear story after story of people who need to be rescued. And we discovered just last time that while God is raising up a little baby called Moses, that our story isn't about Moses who comes to rescue us. Our story is about one who's greater than Moses. Hebrews chapter 3 verse 3 tells us that. One who is greater than Moses has been raised up for us. And so as we journey through this narrative tonight, we need to move between the two worlds of the world that we live in and the world of Egypt, and yet also the world of Christ reconciling himself to us. I read in Mark Dever's book this week about some of William Shakespeare's most popular plays being comedies. And among them, one of the most famous ones is called As You Like It. It's the story of two brothers who become alienated, and when the younger brother usurps the elder's place, has him exiled into a forest. In classic Shakespearean fashion, mistaken identities, romance and folly collide to produce a bit of a good laugh. The play also includes a plain-speaking fool who gives one of his most famous speeches of any Shakespeare play. The fool summarizes the seven stages of man's life from infancy to old age. Yet the most quoted part of this speech is the first line in which the fool says, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women are merely players. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women are merely players. And that's another thing I believe God is teaching us through this book of the Exodus. That while we see many different characters, the people of Israel, Pharaoh, the wickedness of Pharaoh, there's the main actor, God himself, who's not only the actor, but he's the play script writer. He's the one who's got his hand all over this Exodus, even though for 400 years the people are groaning and crying out to God, where have you gone? It seems like you're silent. It seems as if you no longer communicate with us because you promised us back in Genesis that you would never leave us nor forsake us, that you would make us into a great nation and that we would have a land, a seed, and a blessing. But yet here we are, God, and we're under such oppression. And so last time we said, where is God when he seems silent? And we discovered yet last time that God is working, even when he seems silent. And so all the Exodus is a stage, but God is the script writer who's working it together for good. So let's drop down into the text and let's look at this big theme together. God who rescues in the darkest of times. God who rescues in the darkest of times. Firstly, God's rescuer is born. Exodus chapter 2 and verse 1. Follow along with me. Exodus 2 verse 1. Now, a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman. And she became pregnant. And she gave birth to a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, or a beautiful child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. But we need to immerse ourselves a little bit in the culture of Egypt at this time. If you've got your Bible open in front of you, you'll see in Exodus chapter 1 that the darkness has descended for the people. Halfway through Exodus chapter 1, things go from bad to worse to awful. Pharaoh was trying to kill off all the Hebrew babies. He tried to exploit two midwives and tried them to go against the very thing which God had called them to do, to deliver babies into this world. And yet we find two godly women full of faith and vigor and passion for God, who stood in front of Pharaoh and said, we do not serve you, we serve the living God. And now Pharaoh can't get any lower than what he's doing now. All the babies in Egypt are now being killed. But just imagine what this was like for Moses' parents. Moses' parents were slaves. They had no rights. They had no privileges. They know that Pharaoh not only hates Hebrew children, but he wants all boys exterminated. Why? Because he was fearful that those young boys would grow up to become warriors. And because where the Hebrew people lived in Egypt, they were close to the surrounding nations. And if the surrounding nations came, that the Hebrew boys would rise up, join with the surrounding nations, and take over Egypt and depose Pharaoh from his throne. Pharaoh wanted to be God. In fact, he was known as a god of the known world. And yet, Moses' parents have a son. God is beginning to bring light into the darkness. But the amazing thing is, as you and I read this passage, we've got it in front of us. We can read to the end. We can read Exodus chapter 40. In fact, we can read to Revelation 21 tonight. We know the end of the story. But Moses' parents, put yourself back there hundreds of years ago, they don't know the end of the story. God seems to be silent for hundreds and hundreds of years. His promises do not seem to be working out in their lives. One generation rises up with hope. One generation gets old. One generation dies without seeing God's promises fulfilled in their lifetime. And yet the text here tells us that Moses' parents become pregnant and they give birth to a son who was a fine child. And that Hebrew word that is described in our English word fine means something different about this child. This is no ordinary child. This was one whom I believe when Moses' parents looked into his eyes, they knew that there was something supernatural about this child. But look what happens. They have to try and hide the child. Now, I have two children. And trying to hide two children, particularly a newborn child, when killing squads are walking up and down your street, listening morning, noon and night for any cries of a little baby, particularly a little baby boy. Imagine what it was like for Moses' parents trying to hide their young son, knowing that at any moment that particular cry that would ring out into the street, out through that open window, would mean that a killing squad might enter their house and take away their beautiful, their fine child, the one in whom they perhaps believed at this stage was going to make a difference. Imagine what that was like. But yet here in the darkest of situations, God has his people living by faith. And I wonder as you drop down into their world, as you try to identify it with your world, and you're living in a dark situation, and it feels oppressed, and you feel like there's no way out, God is asking you, like he asked Moses' parents, to live by faith. But no longer could they hide this child. Verse 3. So she gets a papyrus basket for Moses, coats it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Now, many parents I know, even myself at times, do not like leaving my children on their own. One, because of the destruction that they will cause. But perhaps mainly because of the danger that they might get into. If I put Maisie on the sofa, will she fall off the sofa and crack her head and I've got to go to the hospital and worse than anything, have to tell Jenny about it? But here is Moses' mother. The baby is just over 3 months old. He is a boy. He is a fine child. She knows that at any moment they're going to identify that this is a boy and he must be killed. And so she goes down to the River Nile. She gets this papyrus basket. And not only was it going to be dangerous about where the baby was going to arrive, but at any moment Moses could have been eaten by an alligator. The Nile was notorious for those that would be killed by alligators in the river. Adults. Never mind a young, defenseless little baby drifting up the River Nile in amongst the reeds. And yet she's faith. Even in the darkest of situations, even when it seems as if God has been silent for so many years, there was something within her that was connecting with God, that she lived by faith, even in the darkest of situations. And so she sends little baby Moses up the Nile, trusting in God for a miracle. So God's rescuer is born, but it's a pretty hard future that he's just entered. But secondly, God's rescuer is rescued. Look at verse 5. God's rescuer is rescued. Look what it says. And as you read these words, only God can write this script. Remember what I read at the beginning, that God is not only the main actor in Exodus, but he is the script writer. Only God can work this situation together, that when Moses is put out in that little basket into the River Nile and then in amongst the reeds, that his sister, Miriam, is actually working for Pharaoh's daughter. Only God can actually bring the sort of supernatural light out of the darkness that we need. Then verse 5. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down, you could say, by chance, or was this God working it together? Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. Did it just so happen? She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. Who was the slave girl? She opened it and saw that the baby was crying, and she felt sorry for him. Now, hold on. This was a young Hebrew boy. This is a young Hebrew boy in a basket in the River Nile when she was going there to bathe. Now, let's think about who she is. She is the daughter of the man who has given an edict that all babies should be killed. And yet God is the main actor. He's actually the script writer here. And he's working in Pharaoh's daughter's heart to rescue the rescuer. He's working in Pharaoh's daughter's heart to rescue the rescuer. Amazingly, now Pharaoh's house will be changed from destroyer to savior. She felt sorry for him, verse 6. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then a sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yeah, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." Some of you ladies would like that, to get paid for looking after your own children. Maybe you do get a little bit from the government. But look at how God is working in the darkness. The situation for God's people, the people of Israel, couldn't get any worse. All the babies are being killed. Their one hope, this fine child Moses, who has been raised up to be a rescuer, is now floating as a three-month-old or a little older on the River Nile. Could have been eaten by an alligator, could have been swallowed up by Pharaoh's daughter because she was the one that is part of the family who gave this edict to kill all the children. And yet in Pharaoh's household, Moses' sister Miriam's working. And Miriam makes a suggestion, and Pharaoh's daughter says yes. And she goes and gets Moses' mother, who's going to bring Moses up. You see, God is working even in the darkest of situations. But look then what happens in verse 10. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him up out of the water." Alec Moitier in his book said this about this scenario. "We can well imagine Moses' mother carrying the baby out and about and being with the baby in the streets." Now, I've got to be honest, I get a little bit anxious when I meet mothers with their children or fathers with their children. They're a newborn. I mean, I love it when the baby's got a little headband on that sort of signifies a girl. You ever get that moment of fright and go, "Oh, lovely child that you have," because you're afraid to say the wrong thing. But you can imagine, Alec Moitier says, that she's out in the street and people say, "That's a lovely little girl you have there, Mrs. Amran." Because, of course, she could not bring a son out in public. They were to be killed. And then her being able to reply, "Oh, no, this is my son, Moses." "Well, then, hadn't you better keep him hidden? Why, you've got to keep him inside. The killing squad will be around any moment." "Certainly not," she could say with confidence. "He's the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. They can't touch him." She had confidence because she knew that Moses was adopted into the household that could not be touched. And yet in our spiritual lives, Ephesians chapter 6 talks about the principalities of powers and darkness which wage war against our soul, which come after us in the society that we live in. And they tell us that you're not a child of God and that there's no way you can be rescued from the darkness. Paul the Apostle was able to say into the church at Rome, which is a very pluralistic, materialistic, hedonistic society. He was able to say in Romans chapter 8 verse 1, "There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ." You've been adopted into the family of God. No one can take that away from you. And so that was to bring hope to the Roman church in their darkest of situation, and to bring hope to you and me in the midst of our dark situations. There's a sense of irony in this situation. Pharaoh's plan of genocide included the preservation of all the daughters. But as things turned out, it's the daughters who are his downfall. His own daughter who will save the rescuer. But then the rescuer grows up, thirdly. God's rescuer is frightened, verse 11. God's rescuer is frightened. Look what it says in verse 11. "One day after Moses had grown up," now that period of growing up is about 40 years, "and he went out to where his own people were, and he watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people." And in those first number of words, there's about 40 years. And Dr. Luke tells us in the book of Acts a little bit about what happens there. And I'll read it to you. In Acts chapter 7, verse 21. When he was placed outside, being Moses, Pharaoh's daughter took him and brought him up as her own son. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and in action. So Moses potentially has spent the majority of his life as one of the princes of Egypt. He's been reared in all the philosophies of the day. He's received the best education. He's received the best training in oratory. He's got the most skilled mind when it comes perhaps to war and waging war against other nations and all of the military history of the day. Why would he leave? He had popularity perhaps. He had prestige. He had power. Why would he leave? He's the prince of Egypt. He's Pharaoh's daughter. He's one of the top people perhaps in the world. And he's grown up in that environment for up to 40 years. But you see, God was working in the midst of the dark situation for his people. And look at some of the language of the rescuer that is describing Moses' life. Verse 11, he went out. He went out to where his own people were. He watched them. He saw one of his own being beaten. And the word that Moses uses himself here in verse 11, he watched them, is the Hebrew word yara. It means to watch with emotion. It means to be intimately involved with the scene that is happening in front of you. And so Moses, who walks out of his palace as an Egyptian, dressed as the prince of Egypt, and he comes out to where all the slaves are in their pit, and he sees a slave master whipping one of his own people. God does something in Moses' heart. And suddenly all of the power, popularity, prestige of Egypt starts to go into the background. But he shouldn't have done this. One writer called Goran Larson did a little bit of work on what the Egyptian curriculum would have been like for Moses. Among these documents, one category of educational material is particularly conspicuous. Namely, texts that express a deep content of manual labor while stressing the great value of study. Studies led to a life far away from the dust and the dirt and the toil of the harsh taskmasters and their slaves. These texts emphasize the extremely low status of the working class in ancient Egyptian society. In some of the texts, slaves are described as the living dead or as compared to donkeys. And Moses would have been taught that his whole life. Don't go out to those folks. They're the living dead. They're nothing better than donkeys. And yet he marches out as the prince of Egypt from his palace. And God is doing something in his heart. Why? Because God is the main actor and he's the script writer. And so Moses is being moved and directed by God. It's a startling reversal because in many of the stories that you read or many of the movies that you see, often the young prince is stolen away at a very young age and goes out to live with the common people. And then when he becomes of age, he becomes a warrior. He goes back to the palace and he reclaims his crown. But there was complete reversal in Moses' life. He was taken as a young child, as a slave, as the living dead, as nothing worse than a donkey, or nothing better than a donkey. And he's taken off to the palace where he grows up with all of the wealth and prestige of the day. He's been indoctrinated in everything Egyptian. He really is an Egyptian. But yet God is doing something in his heart. And the writer to the Hebrews tells us what Moses does. Hebrews chapter 11 verse 24 tells us why Moses did it. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God, rather to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded the disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value or surpassing value than all the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking forward to the reward. You see, just picture Moses. He's living up there in that palace as the prince of Egypt, and he makes the journey as a free man, as a prince, down through Egypt, and he finds the people of God in their pit, in the darkness. Isn't that an incarnational ministry? That the prince would come down from the throne to the prison, to the pit of despair. Isn't that a picture of a rescuer and a redeemer? But doesn't that help you and I tonight think about another picture? About a prince who came from a palace down to another world? In John chapter 1, verse 1, it tells us the Word became flesh and made His dwelling amongst us. And we have seen His glory, the glory of the only one begotten of the God the Father, full of grace and truth. Think about His incarnational ministry, the ministry of Jesus, who when He was a young baby, He was born as a rescuer, but it wasn't Pharaoh, He was dead, He was no longer around. Herod tried to kill Him. He sent an edict out that all the boys in his area were to be killed immediately. And there, the rescuer was born. But then the rescuer, just like Moses, had to be rescued. And so an angel comes and visits Mary and Joseph in the middle of the night and says, you've got to go right now. And so out into the desert, this young teenage couple go, and they're heading where for? For Egypt. Because later it would say in the Bible, out of Egypt I've called my son. So God hasn't sent Moses for us. He sent Jesus, who was born to be our rescuer. Matthew chapter 1 verse 21 says, and you will call His name Jesus, for He will save His people, not from slavery to Pharaoh, but from slavery to sin. And so our rescuer has been born. Our rescuer was rescued by His own Father, directing His human Father to go to Egypt. And our rescuer was frightened. Because what we're going to find here is Moses is going to kill a guy. He's going to step outside of God's will. But our rescuer was also frightened. As he was submitting himself to the will of the Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, when the plan of rescue and redemption lay ahead of him, he said to his Father in Matthew chapter 27, is there any other way out of this? As he looked into the cup of suffering that he would have to go through, he said, Father, is there any other way? The situation seems too dark. And so our rescuer was born, our rescuer was rescued, and our rescuer was frightened. And so here Moses is in a state of fright. Look what it says in verse 12. Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, Moses killed the Egyptian and hid him. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? The man said, who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? And Moses was afraid and thought, what I did must have become known. And when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Moses has just signed his death warrant. By identifying with the civil rights movement of the slave people, the people of Israel, Pharaoh would immediately want him dead. But even worse was the fact that Moses had tried to be God's rescuer in his own wisdom, power, and strength. Perhaps Moses thought, I've received all the wisdom of the day, I've got all the skills of the day, I've got all the philosophies of the day. I'm powerful in speech and in action. Perhaps he thought in his incarnational ministry, he could just march out of the palace and he can immediately redeem the people. But he was doing it in his own strength. God hadn't allowed him to go just yet. God was still preparing his Redeemer. And so he ends up in Midian. He's on the run. He's frightened. He's scared for his life. In a sense, in a moment, he lost everything. From being the favored one to a fugitive. And we find him here sitting down by a well in Midian. Now, Midian was a desert. It was a wilderness. And maybe some of you find yourself there tonight. You feel like just giving up. You feel like Moses, that you've let God down so badly. That you've gone and you've done things in your own strength. You've gone and done things in your own sinful way. And you're sitting with Moses at that well in Midian. Like Elijah sat by another well. Like Elijah sat cowering in a cave, wanting to die. But would there be hope for the rescuer? Would God rescue the rescuer? Would God leave him in a state of depression? Will God leave you and me in our state of depression, particularly in relation to our sinful lives? No, you see, fourthly and finally, God's rescuer is reborn in Midian. God's rescuer is reborn in Midian. Look at verse 16. Now a priest of Midian. Now is this just by chance? Or is this actually God? Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and I was going to say he needed a lot of help, that man with seven daughters. And they came to draw water, just by chance, or is this God? And fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away. But Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. I love that because Moses, in a sense, is in a depressed state. But then a situation, in a sense, happens right in front of him. But God has wired him to be a rescuer. God has wired him to be his redeemer. And so he sees a situation where the innocent are being afflicted. And so God does something within him. And in Midian, from that moment on, the redeemer is reborn. The redeemer is reborn. But Moses has had to spend four decades learning in Egypt. And now he's going to have to spend four decades learning what it means to be reborn in Midian. He's going to spend 4 years in the wilderness. God is going to need to teach Moses what it means to be his servant and his rescuer. And as we've looked over these past Sundays in different texts, it seems to me that God teaches his people, you and I tonight, more in the wilderness than he can teach us in the palace. It's interesting that Moses is going to be taught exactly where he lives. Exactly where he would live in Midian in the wilderness. And God is wanting to teach you and I exactly where we live. And then God brings this situation together that he will have a family. Look at verse 18. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian." You know, he's an Egyptian in their eyes. "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." And a father looking to try and get his daughters married off, of course, says verse 20. "And where is he?" Haven't seen a man like this in the desert in many years. "And where is he?" asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have come to something." And he wants to get those daughters married off, I was thinking. But you see, God wanted to teach Moses, not just about being in the wilderness and where he lived, but Moses wanted to teach him about being part of a family. Because look what the text tells us, verse 21. Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave his daughter Sapphira to Moses in marriage. Sapphira gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." God wanted to teach Moses where he lived. By being a reborn man of faith. God wanted to teach Moses about being a family man, about how to lead his own people in the wilderness. Because think about what God's going to do with Moses in the next couple of weeks. He's going to go back to Egypt. He's going to have to take God's people out of Egypt. And where are they going to live? They're going to live in the wilderness. He's going to come back and he's going to be the leader of God's people, in a sense, the family head, the patriarch of God's people. And he's going to have to lead a family in the wilderness. So in these 40 years where it seems like God is doing nothing and it seems like a dark and dangerous and depressed situation, God is teaching Moses about where he lived. God is teaching Moses and his family. God is shaping us even when it seems like he's not. In the darkest of situations, God is not silent and God is still working. But God wouldn't just teach Moses about where he lived. He wouldn't just teach him and his family. But then he would teach him about his job. He would teach him in his job. Because look what Exodus chapter 3 verse 1 says, if you have the passage open in front of you. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Moses had to live in the wilderness to know what it's like to live in the wilderness. Moses had to have a family in the wilderness to go and lead God's family in the wilderness. Moses had to be a worker in the wilderness as a shepherd. Why? Because he was going to be the shepherd of God's people. But in those 40 years, it must have been so frustrating. But God is preparing you and me in the wilderness. God is preparing you and me in our families. God is preparing you and me in our workplaces. Even if it seems dark and depressing, Moses was going to be the shepherd of God's people. And then, meanwhile, back at the camp, meanwhile, back in Egypt, look what it says, verse 23, what's happening to the people of God? During that long period of 40 years, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. And then look at this lovely picture of God. God is the main actor. God is the script writer. God is now going to move in their lives after hundreds of years of what seems to be silence. God heard their groaning. And he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. The last thing that we need to learn tonight, I think, from this passage is that even in the darkest of situations, prayer is what we need to start with. Prayer is what we need to start with. Because the text tells us that God heard their groaning. But the people of God would have had no idea that God heard their groaning. And you and I tonight, in whatever situation you're dealing with, it may feel like God doesn't hear your groaning. It may feel like God is silent. It may feel like that the heavens are like brass and that your prayers never get up there. And the fact that there's a great high priest who intercedes for us sounds good, but in reality just doesn't seem to work out in your life. But we know the end of this story. God heard their cries. And then I love how this passage ends. And was concerned about them. And as I close tonight, there's lovely words that bring us comfort. And whatever dark situation that you're in tonight, that God's concerned about you. And Peter wrote about it. A man who was a mess and a failure many, many times. And he wrote as an older, godly, wise man. He says in 1 Peter 5, verse 7, casting all your care upon him, because he cares for you, even in the darkest of situations.